attackers today, most of them know where the tripwires are and where they're going to be found out. So much like a home alarm or a motion detector, they know those are there. So they're going to find entrances or methods that avoid that. But still today, the majority of the attacks are not surprises to organizations. Attacks are based on vulnerabilities that we've known about for at least 3 years. The stuff that's going to hurt us is typically things we know about.
Greg Young is the Vice President of Cybersecurity and Corporate Development at Trend Micro, an international cybersecurity product vendor with the aim of making the world safe for exchanging digital information. He's been in the cybersecurity space for over 30 years and has worked with organizations of all shapes and sizes. This is the Cybercrime Lab, a podcast about true cybercrime stories, the impact on victims, and what businesses can do to protect themselves and their customers. And if you think you're not at risk, that is exactly where attackers want you to be.
In my experience, it only takes hearing what these attacks are like a few times to realize you need to prepare yourself for what could be a business-ending experience.
That's Andy Anderson, the founder and CEO of DataStream Insurance. For over a decade, Andy has been working with victims of cybercrime. He's seen firsthand the human impact of a cyber attack. Now, he's on a mission to shed light on the threats we all face from a world we can't see. Today, Andy has invited Greg to the Cybercrime Lab to discuss the major reason why businesses get attacked: vulnerabilities. In fact, Trend Micro discovers more of these vulnerabilities, otherwise known as common vulnerabilities and exposures, CVEs, than some of the best-known cybersecurity firms out there, including Microsoft. Most of the vulnerabilities can be found in Remote Desktop Protocol, or RDP. Greg shares why the majority of these attacks don't come as a surprise for most organizations, why businesses need to invest in their IT departments, and much more.
Greg, thank you so much for coming on the Cybercrime Lab podcast. For those who don't know you and Trend Micro as well, I'd love if you take a minute just to introduce yourself, introduce Trend.
Yeah, thanks. Trend Micro, international cybersecurity product vendor, over 7,000 employees around the world, operates in most countries, and nowadays operating in most of the markets for cybersecurity, from endpoint, server, cloud, risk intelligence side, goes on and on, network security products. So a lot of stuff there, and we have a number of headquarters that are around the world as well. Myself, I've been in cybersecurity for 33 years now. Shocking, even pre-internet stuff. I started in the military doing technical counterintelligence there, working on the first kind of mainframes and systems we had. And then government, I was the CISO for the Federal Department of Communications in Canada, and then off to the private sector. I was a Gartner analyst for about 14 years. And 4 years ago, I joined Trend. And I spent some of my other time working on committees, trying to give back. Some public-private stuff, like some government resilience committees for a couple of countries, including Canada and Barbados.
Yeah, that's awesome. Such a diverse experience. And I'm sure lots of folks see the Trend name in different places, but as I've had different conversations with members of your team, I hadn't quite realized quite how extensive your customer base is and the number of environments that you're protecting. It's in the tens, if not hundreds, if not millions of organizations and kind of every size. I think that's what was particularly interesting about some of the work that you guys do is you protect some of the largest organizations, but also small organizations as well and everything in between. So you sort of get this visibility. And then also you guys maintain one of the kind of early vulnerability alerting services as well. I remember talking with folks. And so you're right on the bleeding edge of as new stuff emerges.
Yeah, we're kind of a well-kept secret. We actually discover more CVEs or vulnerabilities than anyone else, including Microsoft, Cisco, or others. We've got a really great program for that.
I feel like a lot of people take what you're making and then ring the bell of press for it. So you're the unsung hero on a lot of stuff. Before we hit the record button, we were talking a little bit about some of the specific incidents that you've been seeing and one set of incidents all related to a vulnerability. I'd love if we start diving into that story and what you're seeing and lessons that organizations could take from that.
Yeah, having seen a lot of incidents over the years, especially my time at Gartner, I'd be taking a dozen inquiries a day from companies looking for help around the globe, and it was kind of like therapy for them. But one always constant amongst those was that somebody inside was never surprised that this happened. It was very rarely. I think nowadays, maybe that's part of the calculus that has changed now. There are some attacks that we are surprised about, and that's what we're going to lead into, I think, maybe next, to talk about one that did surprise a lot of people that I had some insight into. But still today, the majority of the attacks are not surprises to organizations. I had a prediction I put out at Gartner was that 99.99% of attacks are based on vulnerabilities that we've known about for at least 3 years. So it's just that decimal place has maybe moved a little bit for some of the attacks, but I think that's been the constant, that the stuff that's going to hurt us is typically things we know about.
Can we double click on that just a little bit?
Yeah, sure thing.
We talk with lots of incident responders and lots of folks who are seeing these attacks and the damage that accompanies them. And at various points, I've been blown away by what is the top of the stack in terms of driving incidents. So I haven't caught up with a whole set of incident responders in a couple of months, but the last time I did, it was still RDP, remote desktop protocol issues, which are driving a huge percentage of attacks. It was still some Microsoft Exchange vulnerabilities with email that was driving a huge percentage. Yes, I mean, in the measured in years that we've known about these issues being there, why do you think that they don't get addressed?
There's a couple, and you made a great comment before we went live about that it sounds so easy to do things like backup or patch things, but it's really not. But there's two parts to this. So the first is that it is not always trivial to patch things or to even today locate the stuff that needs patching. It's not like the CIO owns all the IT anymore. With about $1 in $6 or $1 in $7 now being spent on IT outside the CIO's organization and companies, that means that there's a lot of IT that you don't even know about. You have to go out and find it and then try to embrace it with your security envelope.
Cybersecurity is very familiar with acronyms. You'll notice that Greg refers to CSOs and CIOs several times in this episode. A CSO is a chief security officer. They're in charge of any given company's security, both digital and physical. A CIO, or chief information officer, is in charge of a business's digital information security. And now you know.
So that's one, I think, is defining it. And then the disruption of patching is there. And often, if you look at stuff that's embedded in IoT, for example, that's really hard to find because in most organizations that have a lot of industrial compute, they keep that separated from the IT side. There's a big wall and they don't want stuff going between that. Even the cultures are different on both sides of that. So it's people, it's cultures, it's ability to patch findings. And this is the hardest stuff to find. Some of it's easy to find and isolate and some things you can't patch. That's the patching side. The other side, I think, is that the bad guys now are moving laterally so often. They're going to get in somewhere and they may get in, but there's nothing they can really exploit there. So they're going to say, right, we're going to keep moving around until we find something that's going to be on that top 10 list that we can exploit. We're going to find that RDP service. We're going to find that old Exchange server, and we're going to then own that machine so we can get in, but then to actually exploit and do damage, then we're going to find some really soft, squishy stuff.
If you're not an IT person and your interaction with having to deal with IT problems is consumer tech, like, oh, we just reset this, or we say yes, you know, when the prompt comes up on your machine and says, yes, refresh the software here and install the patches. That experience is so different than what a corporate IT organization needs to do, let alone into the operational technology where anytime a machine or a computer is attached to a physical thing, like a production line or anything else where you're taking this into manufacturing or operations. It's planned for months, if not years, when you're going to take down these systems, putting it back on. You have whole processes to make sure that it comes back on as expected and then continues to operate as expected.
Oh, yeah. Especially large organizations. Like imagine a bank with your online banking applications. If you have critical elements of that, yes, you're going to be able to have enough availability that you can have components go down and other ones that'll be there. But just the dance that's required for business critical stuff or real-time trading. Real-time trading environments often won't even allow a firewall on the inside because that would slow things down and they would lose business. So imagine trying to take down a large part of the infrastructure in that to fix it, re-architect it, or patch it. That is really challenging. Those windows keep getting pushed out and pushed out because of the real impacts on business. Yeah, it's not the update button. You're right. It's incredibly challenging.
I always get this picture of people spinning plates on their fingers. It is often, I think, for those people who aren't, everything looks like shiny and well put together. And then you actually start walking into these server rooms and looking at what the architecture of these different systems are. And it's the proverbial like bubblegum and popsicle sticks, like holding stuff together. That pain of, if it ain't broke, why are we going to fix it? And not being able to see that it is broken because it's riddled with vulnerabilities and things that, yes, it still operates, but it's not built for fault. It's not built to resist and survive and recover from the things that you have an active group of individuals and criminals and other threat actors who are trying to throw bombs at it and break it and disrupt it and then benefit from.
You never hear a board of directors getting really mad because somebody's slow at patching stuff. That's not the stuff that gets on their agenda unless they're a really enlightened board. It's going to be most often somebody interrupted business and how do we make sure this doesn't happen again? So even if they're trying to do the right thing, it was poorly architected 10 years ago. They're trying to patch the spaghetti. They do the right thing. They take a hit. Let's say it goes wrong and you lose business on a Sunday for part of the day. That's what's going to get attention and people get in trouble. But if you sit there and do nothing, many organizations, that's indirectly rewarded.
There are those tensions. The board is trying to minimize cost and at the same time minimize risk. And sometimes they're in opposition. And security is often just seen as a cost center. So they're just like, can't we save on this? And then there's also the real struggle for metrics. Okay, if we do this, what's going to improve? And that's not a simple story. Let's talk about one of the things, the reason that we do this podcast is to, you know, to help people maybe learn from mistakes that they didn't have to feel themselves or lessons that they could learn from others. So let's talk about the specific incident that hit a number of organizations and maybe the lessons that could be learned from that.
I love cautionary tales. I think we're primordially hardwired for them. That's why people are afraid of snakes or things like that. Tell me about that creature that attacked you and other people learned from it. So I think this is really valuable. I think the threat landscape has changed quite a bit. This is the lead up to this series of incidents was state actors getting involved. State actors were always kind of in the background. They were never really there. People would blame them for things that were typically not really. We even saw that because a lot of countries didn't pay their people really well, their own sort of cyber spies that they would go off on their own at night and do damage, ransom things, and to make extra money, to make ends meet. But of course, that country would get blamed when it's really just these guys trying to feed their family using the company tools. But this migrated on. We're certainly seeing now, but this became much more active. Leading up to this, the most sophisticated attacks, which are often overhyped, but in this case, it was one that was highly effective. Attackers today, most of them know where the tripwires are and where they're going to be found out. So much like a home alarm or a motion detector, they know those are there. So they're going to find entrances or methods that avoid that. They'll go through the air ducts. They'll go do something else to try to avoid tripping those to cover their tracks.
As Greg mentions, much like burglars who break into homes or businesses, cyber threat actors work hard to find the best back way into an organization. In our story today, you'll soon discover the cunning way that threat actors made their way into the business in question. It all has to do with management tools. If you or someone in your organization uses management tools, you're going to want to listen especially close.
One thing that this attack showed was that there are open source components that are used, open source or third-party components that use often a chain of things such as open source components within them or other kinds of components that are buried within them. And you will never know that they're in there. So much like if you have third-party components in your car, if it's made by another company, you will never know that. The manufacturer will, unless you're a mechanic, you may have some hint of that. But these are buried in there and they're never kind of on the list of ingredients. And knowing this, the attackers went after a doubly smart thing. One is they went after some components in one of the related attacks that was related to open source. And the other, they went after an infrastructure component. And what do I mean by an infrastructure component? It's stuff that helps sort of, it's the air conditioning and stuff that keeps the power on inside your applications and the like, or monitoring tools. And those have inhabited a really special place inside of corporate IT. That when we cut up our IT into these zones to limit the impact of things or to keep things safe, we always have these zones. So there's the entranceway, which is the edge. We have zones with different sensitivities of information in them. So if you have HIPAA information or other personal information, credit card information for PCI environments, we have zones we create for those because we know it's special information. But one kind of back hallway that joins all these together is the management zone. Management monitoring is done there, and additionally backup. Because we have to do tasks often that we're going to touch a lot of things that our super users and our admins are going to use. So like in the Matrix where they had the keymaster who was opening doors in the back, it's much like that. You can get to the whole enterprise through these management zones and they're necessary. because this is where your monitoring information comes in. This is where you will do your backups. Quite often, you will have a backup zone that touches all these things because you have to back up your information. You have to touch all this stuff. And there's been a recognition, though, that these management tools and the like have to be exceptionally protected. So like a master key or a hallway that only employees can go through in some kind of sensitive place, air ducts or the like, that has to be specially protected. And some of those protections around that have crumbled and become weaker over time. So part of it is that the tools that we're using there aren't the little sort of nuggets that we used to use, that these are now big, complex things that will use third-party components. And the people that produce these often don't really get excited about security because this is the stuff of management. Nobody buys a management tool because it's secure. They buy a management tool because it's really good at managing stuff. It's either they got the newest stuff, it's going to get you promoted because it does it faster, it makes your job easier. You can do these tasks to do deployment. So that's one change. The other is that these hallways and the infrastructure that we have has also become software defined. So we don't have a solid concrete walls that we could build around a lot of these sort of internal passageways. Now they are virtualized. They can be moved. So like if you go in a hotel and you set up a meeting space, and you got these walls you slide around that go back and forth. It's like that, except there's not that even that kind of structure. So with our software-defined wide area networks now, we can restructure things for good or for bad. So the really nice, rigid, well-defined, elegant management pathways that we had get much sloppier now. They're also leaking around, could be so many different cloud vendors. So it turns out that this has become a really great target. So in this series of incidents, one of them was that one of the tools used by a lot of companies in this area itself was compromised where the software was produced. This was also very different because we're so used and we've been so hardwired about patching things like we've talked about. We're going to patch stuff. Our stuff will be vulnerable and we're going to patch it. So there's kind of a recognition that the known version of what is produced and the vendor will have knowledge of what's there. But in this case, the software was compromised, not, hey, look, we found a hole. We're going to exploit the hole. This was a hole was put in there at the time of manufacture. That flaw was intentionally inserted there, which effectively, I can't recall an incident where we've seen that before, except in some really unusual cases dealing with security level stuff where somebody would go to that kind of trouble to do that. But in this case, that was done.
And I've read a little bit about this specific incident. We won't name names. Just to expand on what that looks like, imagine that you had old school like telephones that someone was, rather than trying to break into your house and insert bugs in the phones, they literally like just broke into the phone manufacturing and dropped the bug into the manufacturing process. So every phone had this in it. And then even though you bought a new phone, it's fully boxed up. It's got all the proper cellophane sealing on it. When you open the phone and you plug it into the wall, you're already essentially vulnerable because that bug's already in there. It is truly next level. Everyone around this incident assumes that that's probably that level of sophistication, that level of effort was probably a nation state doing that.
That's pretty acknowledged, yeah. And again, this is really interesting because this is something that we really weren't structured to find before. In fact, it's almost impossible to find. You can see the results of when it's being exploited, but that level of backdoor, until it's used, you don't know it's there, and nor would anybody be expected to find that. When the manufacturer themselves doesn't know it's there, that is exceptionally challenging because it's on the inside of their code. And yes, we have some ability to look at applications to check their behavior and the like, but until it is exploited, if it's quiet, it is effectively a blind spot. So this falls into that 99.999 I talked about. This is in that 0.001 of exploits and attacks that would happen that you didn't see coming.
In this incident, so this was there, and basically, I think it's a little murky in terms of how this was discovered. I think that what happened was one of the security vendors discovered it, but I've also heard rumor that that discovery was passed to that vendor from perhaps some other resources.
Yeah, so there's a couple of stories around. So the lesson is don't just look for the initial exploitation behavior. You also have to look for when this is running and doing it. There has to be some activity that's going to benefit the attacker at some point. So that's what you have to look for. Don't just look for the attempt to insert the exploit. If it's pre-exploited, you still have to look for that behavior. And I think we've been a little better about that. This is where MITRE has been really helpful. But that kind of stuff we can spot, but not as immediately. You're not going to spot it before it occurs. You're going to see the damage going off. But then you're exactly right. What was the response? So one suspicion was that one of the security vendors you spotted, it was actually victim to it. that they detected it because they got owned. They got hit. They saw this exploitation happen. They're going, my God, we've been attacked successfully. We've been compromised. We're seeing this compromise happen. We're seeing data go. How did this happen? And so that was this one theory about the discovery of it, was that they themselves were a target. They got attacked successfully. And only after they were compromised did they find it.
And it goes to a conversation that I was having with someone, actually, as chance would have it, this morning around overall defense strategy and where the, and this is probably a higher level discussion than we normally have on this podcast, but when you think about the sort of dynamic of attacker versus defender, and that actually most of the advantages or many of the advantages accrue to the attacker to create any sort of compromise. There's so many different ways for an attacker to get into an organization and start messing with you. This is an extreme one because the amount of effort that they were willing to do to get there, like literally inserting this in manufactured components and dropping it into organizations. You've seen lots of other ways, right? Because again, an attacker can just keep trying new and new stuff and they might fail 99.9% of the time, but
they just have to be right once.
They have to be right once. But actually, the advantages flip on the other side. Once you get into an organization, a defender has a lot of the advantages because they essentially control the battle space now. They control their internal organization and what it looks like and how it changes and where there are tripwires and all of those sorts of things. And so if you've got to do one in 99 to get in, but then you also have to play that game again and you keep running into defenses and particularly into alerts that show you something's going weird. Again, like the knowledge and the learning and the advantages are, again, flipped to the defender. I think we spend a lot of time thinking about stopping, adding to the 99 on the outside and less on the internal stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And how do we find these kinds of compromises? Because we're so afraid of the false positive. We're so afraid of generating too many alerts and also having alerts that could be wrong, because now we're looking indirectly at things.
Maybe for the listener who doesn't understand what exactly a false positive is and why it's so problematic.
Within an organization, it's important to be aware of both false positives and false negatives. Greg explains what the two are up next, but before he does, it's important to understand that both technology and company culture have a role to play in whether or not businesses take them seriously. The biggest takeaway? If you're a business leader, CSO or CIO, it's important to implement a culture that is open and transparent. Only then will your team feel comfortable going to you with a concern. If it turns out to be a false alarm, all the better. The key is to be aware.
Yeah, it's a false alarm. It used to be really easy in security. If we had bad things happen, it would be very obvious, get an alert, and that alert was almost always right. But over time, it became less sure. Things are more complex. So we have two things that we like to avoid are false positives and false negatives. False positives are, hey, we think we're under attack, and it turns out we're not, which you wouldn't think is a big deal until you talk about the scales of large enterprises. That if you're throwing thousands of false alerts at your operators, they're going to get buried and miss the good ones, but also they're going to get fatigued. But also that's not an efficient system to operate under. The second thing is the false negatives is where you're going to get an alert and you're going to miss it, or an alert isn't generated where it should have been. So this tuning now and using technology to help with that is really important. But I think one of the big lessons was that there were many organizations I saw who took a long time to respond to these incidents, the ones who were affected, they took a really long time to recognize it. And that was not technology in some cases, it was culture. In other cases, it was technology that there were indirect indicators here that would absolutely show that you had a problem. There was activity going on in places that shouldn't be going on, that had never been seen before. But that's a really hard kind of thing to spot. So there were organizations who responded quickly because of culture and also their tech. And they were to say, hey, look, this seems really unusual. What's going on? We're seeing activity in places we shouldn't see it, from individuals we shouldn't be seeing it, and entities. So that is suspicious, but that is really hard to spot. And especially if you don't know what normal looks like, just learning what a normal activity is in your network or your systems, it turns out a really hard thing to gauge. But so for some organizations, you're able to spot that. And the ones who are most prepared were the ones who are using non-standard security telemetry, which is, these are indicators that you have an attack that aren't the traditional ones. In your home, you may have a water detector in case of floods, but do you look at what your water flow is telling you? If suddenly you have this incredible water flow you've never had before in water usage, that could be an indicator that maybe your water detector is not working but you're still being flooded. And that's the kind of stuff we're trying to link together today. So we have many kinds of these non-standard telemetry that when joined together can form an even more positive picture than the big kinds of really easy, obvious, easy button ones we had before.
Yeah, I've heard a bunch of folks talk about some of the stuff. They're just monitoring data flow over their networks, right? Because it's often the reason that you're inside is you're trying to get data out. They just are seeing how much data is flowing out, and weird, like if there's big spikes in it or there's data flowing out at hours when the business isn't open or times then they didn't typically see it.
And it can be subtle because the bad guys may watch and monitor that for a while and then say, we're not going to send out 5 terabytes. We're going to send out just a few megabytes at a time. But even that could be at a really finely tuned way, could be unusual. It's just really hard to spot if you're not attuned to it. But if you put together enough indicators together, it can be really compelling. It's not just sort of one obvious smoke detector alert. It is many kinds of information going together to say that this is obviously non-standard. This is really unusual. We may not even know the source of it, but we know there's something really bad going on here we haven't seen before. We think you've been compromised. And that's a new kind of data joining that's going on in the industry that I think is definitely the future to ending this kind of stuff.
And for someone who's listening to this, who's, again, not a technical person, but a business owner, what's the lesson that they may need to take away? Like, how do we make this actionable for not an enterprise type business leader, but more of a sort of small to medium sized business owner? What would you wish that they would do? Having listened to this?
A couple of things. So one is, if you don't have the expertise in-house, make that decision to outsource it. Get help from experts, especially for small and mid-sized organizations. They're so challenged right now with the environment we're in for workforce right now, this cybersecurity skills gap, where we don't have enough people, that shortage. If you can't get the level of expertise you need, get some outside help, especially for after hours. There's no shame in that. If you're in charge of IT for those kinds of organizations, that's fine. You're doing your company a service. Get that extra help you need. The other thing is, start asking yourself what you've been spending your money on to date and say, how much of this my stuff is talking together? If my stuff is not talking together amongst these 30 security products I have, maybe we should start investigating how we can get some information exchange to try to make ourselves more defendable, even with the stuff that we already have. So that can be a low-cost thing as we look towards something like a recession possible. Without spending more money, we can actually get more security bang.
Do you feel like it's getting better or getting worse? Are we shoveling sand against the ocean here, or are we actually starting to build dams and dikes that might keep us a little drier?
We've got fantastic stuff out there what we can do now, but I think there's a real gap between the haves and the have-nots. That shoe manufacturer, who's a mid-sized organization with the level of IT they have versus a very large bank, that bank is not going to get hurt unless it's a really big, unusual attack. But the people who are the least offended are the victims right now. And it really is victim stuff. I never use victim names. Kind of people have been hit because this really does disrupt people's lives. The average lifespan has been quoted for CISOs is about 18 months on average. That's personally disruptive on people's lives when they get taken to task for rightfully or wrongly and having to disrupt their lives and go through the stress of this. It's hard on everybody. And CIOs, by the way, have about the same lifespan on average, is about 18 months on average. It may be 24 months, may have gone up to that recently, but this is highly impactful to people. So I think we've made some technology gains. The gap has widened. I think how we construct ourselves, though, is falling behind. So security is doing great, but the way we run our IT is still designing cars without thinking about safety.
Yeah, I would agree. And unfortunately, what I often see, I think it's so easy to point fingers. What makes the news isn't often the real story, because the real story is more complicated and probably not as, it's fun to point fingers and say, how dumb were you for doing this? But the fact that there's 10,000 potential ways that this could have broken is not a story. That's not news. And I hear it from the IT community, and I think it comes from a place of trying to help, but perhaps misguided. It
comes from a place of love.
I can fix this if I just design something better. Go, I just need to like design essentially like their version of a Rube Goldberg machine. And complexity is the enemy of consistency. And so often, simple, consistent implementation of the basics done over and over and over again would do so much more than a one-time big project, complex system that who's going to maintain when your 18 months is over or 24 months. They're not building for do it fast, do it cheap, do it again and again. They lean towards the other end. Greg, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Look forward to chatting again, and we'll get this up all over the place. And if people want to find more of the stuff that you're doing, more of the trend stuff, where would they go?
So, you know, Trend Micro, you know, it's an easy website to find. I'm on Twitter at Orange Klaxon. It's a place to find some of my stuff. And additionally, the Real Cybersecurity Podcast is another place I spend some of my time as well.
Yeah, love it. Cool. Well, thank you, Greg. Great to chat.
Yeah, likewise. This is really great stuff. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cyber Crime Lab, brought to you by Datastream Insurance. When the worst happens, you're going to want the best financial, legal, and technical support to get you back up and running again. With cyber insurance from Datastream, we find the most comprehensive insurance coverage on the market alongside critical post-incident customer support. Go to datastreaminsurance.com today and see how we can help you secure your business data. That's datastreaminsurance.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe and give us a 5-star review. You'll find show notes and any resources mentioned at cybercrimelabpodcast.com. We hope you'll join us next episode. Until then, stay safe. More importantly, stay ready.